This week in KMA Land, we look back at some of the top big events that happened in KMA Land in 2025 through our KMA Flashback 25 series. I'm Ethan Hewitt, filling in for the vacationing Mike Peterson as we put a bow on the year that was 2025. Well, we started by looking back at recapping one of the most compelling city school election campaigns in recent memory. Mike Peterson reported on the showdown in the Shenandoah mayor's race.
One of the longest citywide election campaigns started in June when incumbent Roger McQueen announced his candidacy for another term as Shenandoah's mayor. First elected in November 2021, McQueen succeeded Dick Hunt, who retired after four terms as mayor. In an interview on KMA's Morning Line program, McQueen cited numerous accomplishments during his first term as mayor and his desire to accomplish more in his second term.
I kind of laugh, you know, I think the first one was the rock pile on Ferguson in 48. I had so many people, when are you going to get that rock pile moved? You know, the Johnson Brother Mill, what can we do for that? What can we do? And so I think we've seen what's happened there. The Sack and Save lot, although there hasn't been a whole lot of action right there, but it's in the process. It's going as fast as it possibly can. You know, the senior housing finished up. You know, we've seen some businesses come up along the 59 corridor. You know, we've seen some new homes built.
Though McQueen defeated seven other candidates in his first campaign 4 years ago, he soon faced a major challenge from Jerry Wagaman, who announced his campaign in August. In a similar Morning Line interview, Wagaman said he's considered running for a city government spot before.
Twice I've looked at running for city council, and with the job that I have or had before I retired, did not actually allow me the time to actually focus on trying to be a city council member. And I was actually looking at running for city council this last go around here. And some friends and some other people approached me and said, maybe you might want to consider running for mayor instead. And so that's what I've decided to do.
McQueen and Wagaman joined candidates for three Shenandoah City Council seats in a public forum airing live on KMA in October from the Gladys Wersig Jones Auditorium. One of the major campaign issues addressed by the candidates was the need for transparency in city government. Saying he believes the city is getting the information out to the public, McQueen says there's opportunities for improvement in terms of transparency.
We're in a changing world with the internet and everything else. And so we have tried, you know, in the last year or so to get some of these things maybe up to date a little more where people, because we did find out that more people use the internet to find information. So, you know, we're trailing in that, and I'll be the first to say we are.
However, Wagaman indicated city government wasn't transparent enough.
You know, we look at a lot of ordinances that the city has involved. Everybody seems to be talking about the fact the only way they can find out about an ordinance is to actually go to the city hall, ask somebody about it. To me, I believe that something like that is something that should be posted online. All city ordinances, in my opinion, should always be posted online so they're accessible 24/7 to everybody to go see and see what's going on.
Another hot issue involved the city's Stage 4 water conservation restrictions. During a KMA Meet the Candidates interview, Wagaman was asked whether he would have done anything differently in order for the city to avoid its current water situation.
As far as what I would have done then at the time, don't know if I would have said I would have been a little bit more proactive in looking at what our well situation was at the time and make sure everything was updated, make sure all the maintenance was being performed on everything properly, and that we actually weren't having issues with wells coming online, going offline, and that everything was actually working in order.
McQueen, however, says the city has been proactive about the water situation for the past year and a half, with new water wells and the proposed Fremont Buried Channel Aquifer Project.
We did put two new wells in. They are online. That's given us a little more water coming in. But you know what? If we don't get the rain, we don't fill the wells up. So the next option was, and this is what we're in the process of doing right now, is running a 6.5-mile pipe from the Fremont Channel Aquifer west of town into our water plant.
After a long and often arduous campaign, McQueen defeated Wagaman by 114 votes, or more than 55% of the vote. I'm Mike Peterson.
And like most years, 2025 also had its fair share of wet severe weather events. While not as wild as the record tornado outbreak in Iowa in 2024, 2025 saw two doses of severe weather and some close calls. Mike Peterson has more.
Though most of KMA land was spared the disasters that marked 2024, including tornadoes in Minden and Greenfield, 2025 had its moments when it comes to severe weather. One major outbreak occurred on April 17th.
It was certainly a scary evening.
That's National Weather Service meteorologist Makila Wood summing up an eventful evening of severe weather. Strong thunderstorms roared through eastern Nebraska and southwest Iowa, generating tornadoes, including a tornado emergency in Page County. Wood says two supercells touched off a long list of weather warnings.
The first was produced kind of near the Columbus area and then tracked east, kind of skirting the northern part of the Omaha metro. And with that one, we've had a brief tornado reports as well as hail up to baseball size. Had some strong winds as well, so we had some baseball-sized hail driven by winds and a lot of damage from that hail.
The second supercell originated near Grand Island and trekked eastward, dropping tornadoes in Cass County before crossing the Missouri River. It then generated a tornado reportedly touching down south of the Fremont Mills K-12 complex in Tabor. More than 40 structures were damaged in the tornado's trek across the county into Page County. Pierce Creek Recreation Area was next along the Twister's Path. Page County Conservation Director Michelle Spinagle says much of the recreational area's damage was concentrated on the park's north end around the campgrounds.
It was all tree damage is what I'm seeing, and then obviously debris from some neighboring houses. And so Friday we did the smaller stuff, and then today we started to tackle the bigger stuff, the larger branches on the ground. We had one tree upright, and then we've still got some big branches that are stuck up inside trees that we need to attend to tomorrow. So I'm hoping here in the next couple of days we'll be all done, and that'll be open back up for everybody.
Peg Franks lives a mile and a half west of Essex on 140th Street. Franks says she was in a shelter when the Twister unleashed its fury upon her residence. Frank says the Twister left a substantial mess in its wake.
I had like 40 and 50 foot evergreen trees, and it sheared the tops of those right off. It uprooted two of other trees. There's branches and other, I got lots of trees down. It looked like a war zone this morning. I have big holes in my siding, like baseball, softball size holes in the siding. So, and then I had some roof damage and twisted the gutters and some of those, you know, things.
Weather Service officials issued this dire warning as the Twister approached Essex.
At 8:49 p.m., a confirmed large and destructive tornado was observed 3 miles west of Essex, or 13 miles southwest of Red Oak, moving east at 30 miles per hour. Tornado emergency for Essex, Iowa. This is a particularly dangerous situation. Take cover now.
Fortunately, most of Essex was spared. Page County Emergency Management Coordinator Jill Harvey was among the officials checking on damage the next day. Harvey told KMA News the survey pointed to a definite path of damage the Twister left in its wake.
It was just north of town and up past like the Nyman area, and then it heads north, and then the damage stopped. We do have, I'll say, a handful maybe of homes that have been completely demolished. A lot of the additional damage is minor damages to homes, and then a lot of outbuildings, and then again, all the trees.
Parts of Taylor County also felt the wrath of severe weather that night, with damage near Bedford and Lenox. The second major storm outbreak in KMA land occurred in the early morning hours of August 10th. A cluster of storm activity roared through southeast Nebraska and southwest Iowa, dumping heavy rainfall and high winds clocked between 60 to 75 miles per hour and higher in some cases. Chris Franks is a meteorologist with the National Weather Service's Valley, Nebraska office. Franks tells KMA News storms started to gather steam shortly after midnight.
About midnight, we actually had a pretty healthy line and a complex of thunderstorms in south-central Nebraska. So this would be south of Hastings, kind of near the Nebraska-Kansas border, that gathered steam, moved to the northeast, and really sort of carved a path of heavy rain and strong winds across southeast Nebraska into southwest Iowa.
The early morning storm was responsible for one storm-related death in Shenandoah. Shenandoah Police Chief Josh Gray says 42-year-old Brian Sego of Kansas City, Missouri, was killed while camping at Sportsman's Park as a rider in the annual Rooster Tail Ride along the Wabash Trace Nature Trail.
Around 3:30, obviously, we know that all the storms come rolling through with all the damage we saw in town. And then officers were dispatched along with rescue down to Sportsman's Park area around 4 a.m. for other riders had found a scoreboard with a shed that had topped over and had landed on the 42-year-old's tent that he was sleeping in.
Shenandoah's storm damage prompted a united cleanup effort. Employees from numerous city departments are out in full force with a ward-by-ward initial thrust in clearing debris from the severe storm. Those same early morning severe storms dealt major tree damage and some structural damage to parts of southeastern Fremont County. I'm Mike Peterson.
And still to come on This Week in KMA Land, we'll look back at the year that was in Page County and also the continuing debate surrounding carbon pipelines. Welcome back to This Week in KMA Land. We'll be continuing along in our Flashback 25 series by looking back at another eventful year for Page County. Well, the new year brought new faces to elected roles in Page County, not only due to the November 2024 elections, but also a special election for Page County Auditor in February featuring two candidates, Kristen Wagoner and Cindy Van Fossen. Well, the Board of Supervisors had appointed Van Fossen to the role in late 2024 before a citizen's petition forced the special election. On election night, February 4th, Wagoner emerged victorious, receiving 65% of the vote. Or prior to being elected to the role, Wagoner had worked for 2.5 years in the auditor's office, most recently as a deputy auditor. In a Meet the Candidates interview, Wagoner said she was running for the position due to her experience.
I do feel that the role of the auditor needs to have experience with county government and elections, which I do. And I feel like my previous experience gave me, and the education I have, gave me the qualifications that I would be able to do a good job.
County Auditor Melissa Wellhausen's resignation in November last year set in motion the chain of events leading to the special election. And another longtime figure in county government also bid farewell early in the year, as former county attorney Carl Songson submitted his resignation in January to pursue a new career opportunity with the Iowa Attorney General's Office after serving as county attorney for over 9 years. At a January 28th board meeting, Songson said the opportunity with the AG's office was one he couldn't turn down.
It's an opportunity that came up that I didn't expect to come up and really couldn't pass up. And the other thing is I've been in the county attorney's office 17 years, and that 17 years happened awfully quickly. Didn't even realize it had been 17 until I, you know, looked at it, so it's been an honor to serve citizens of Page County.
Well, the Board of Supervisors then named interim city county attorney Jim Varley to the full-time position in April, serving the remainder of Songson's unexpired term through the end of 2026. And Page County law enforcement also ushered in a new era this year in more way than one. Page County Sheriff Charles McCullough began his first term in the role in January, succeeding Lyle Palmer, who had served as county sheriff for 16 years. Additionally, county officials also broke ground on a new law enforcement center on the county farm just off U.S. Highway 71 on the south end of Clarinda. Supervisors Chair Judy Clark was among the officials thanking voters for approving a $16.7 million bond issue in November 2023, which made the project possible. Clark says the groundbreaking is not just a one-afternoon celebration, but the culmination of years of planning and investing for the new jail's construction.
I can remember as far back as the 1980s talking about the need for a new jail, and into the 1990s talking about the need for a new jail, and again into the 2000s and the 2010s talking about the need for a new jail, and it kept being put off. A jail isn't something we necessarily want to have, but it's something we're mandated to have for the protection of our citizens.
Former Sheriff Lyle Palmer says it took Band-Aids on tourniquets to keep the existing facility, constructed in 1936, open and avoid closure by state jail inspectors.
There was always that possibility that we would get shut down. Speaking with the state jail inspector, not only on his state jail inspections, but at the schools that I would go to, I knew that if we didn't do something, that we would be shut down. The old jail has served Page County very well. When it was designed, it was one of the top jails in the area. The design of it was pretty much foolproof. And over time, of course, with technology and everything else, it had lived its life and then some.
Plans call for the facility to be completed in the summer of 2026. County officials also heard heated comments from both proponents and opponents of reopening the gun range at Pierce Creek, which had been closed in 2023 due to a lack of volunteers to operate it and review the bylaws. Well, the County Conservation Board approved beginning the process of reopening the facility in May, with the Board of Supervisors also hearing comments the following week at their regular meeting. Rick Rivers is a member of the committee formed to reopen the range and had expressed disappointment in how the conservation meeting was handled by all sides. Rivers said he wanted to reopen the range to have a safe place to train, citing the facility's past track record.
My interest in having a range open is I need a safe place to take kids and train them, okay? Because when I get ready to go on a mentor hunt with a kid, I want to know that when I put a turkey in front of him, he knows what that gun's about, he knows how to use it, and he can hit that target and be successful. In this area, that's our option.
Well, throughout the year, the board also backed the sale of the former engineer's office in Clarinda after staff relocated to the county annex building, and also backed initial plans in December to seek bids on a courthouse roof and clock tower replacement project in 2026. And our Flashback 25 series also turned to the continuing debate and progress on proposed carbon pipelines throughout the region, as that's one of the biggest stories to grip K-Mainland not only in 2025, but for really the past 4 years, revolving around Summit Carbon Solutions' Midwest Express CO2 pipeline, a two-phase proposal to carry captured CO2 from over 60 ethanol plants across a five-state region to a sequestration site in North Dakota. While stipulations were put in place, the Iowa Utilities Commission approved a permit for the project in 2024. For years, the Iowa legislature had also struggled to find a compromise on how to address the use of eminent domain for such projects until a special session in May 2025. By the slimmest of margins, the Iowa Senate passed House File 639, which compiled several bills passed by the Iowa House aimed at limiting eminent domain for carbon pipelines after 12 Senate lawmakers boycotted passing any budget legislation until a carbon pipeline bill was considered on the Senate floor. But that legislation would ultimately be vetoed by Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds. Speaking with reporters in Glenwood after a roundtable discussion in the fall, Reynolds said that the bill would have had unintended consequences on Iowa's energy reliability and economy.
I don't believe they wanted, or I don't think that was the goal, but we need to take a look at making the process better too. I'd like to see more of that in the bill, but it just, we'll see where it goes if people are willing to sit down and have a conversation and find a path forward where we can find some kind of a compromise that you can get the votes.
Landowners and proponents of the legislation blasted the governor's veto. In a June press conference organized by the Iowa Sierra Club and Bold Alliance, Imogene landowner Marty Mayer strongly opposed the governor's veto of the legislation.
By your veto of HF 639, you have classified those of us that support it as unreasonable. Perhaps your opinion is the result of your lack of leadership on this issue for 4 years. You seem to think that Iowa landowners that you supposedly protect should be exposed to liability issues caused by a multi-billion dollar pipeline. We cannot insure against their mishaps, but you seem to think they should not be held responsible.
Well, the battle over carbon pipelines is also expected to reach the U.S. Supreme Court after Shelby and Story counties filed a writ of certiorari with the High Court in October in their case against Summit. Well, the counties seek to appeal the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals' June ruling that upheld a lower court's order barring counties from implementing ordinances regulating carbon sequestration projects. Well, Summit sued both Shelby and Story counties in 2022 for approving local regulations, arguing that federal safety laws preempted the county's ordinances. A federal district court granted Summit summary judgment in 2023, prohibiting the counties from enforcing the ordinances. Well, at an August meeting, former Shelby County Supervisor Steve Kenkel, who has served as the CO2 pipeline liaison for the board, says the results thus far in the lawsuit have contradicted guidance from federal regulators and the Iowa Code.
The Federal Pipeline Hazardous Materials Safety Administration, which we all refer to as PHMSA, has repeatedly said that all levels of government, federal, state, and local, have a role in safeguarding the public for hazardous pipelines. Iowa's zoning law requires every county to consider safety when designing zoning ordinances. The Eighth Circuit ruling is contradicting Iowa law by saying safety cannot be considered.
Also in our KMA Flashback 25 series, we covered the year in Shenandoah, more on the city school elections, KMA's 100th anniversary celebration, the year in education, renewable energy projects developing in KMA land, and other notable events in KMA land communities. Well, that wraps up this week in KMA land. Be listening each week at this time for This Week in KMA Land. And for more information all the time, you can log on to KMALand.com, where you can also hear this program in its entirety. For the KMA News Team, this is Ethan Hewitt. Have a great weekend and a Happy New Year. This Week in KMA Land, a presentation of KMA News, keeping the region informed for 100 years.